We're back with John Dominic Crossan. We've been discussing the material that Dr. Crossan and the late Marcus Borg wrote about in their book titled The First Christmas. And this is the fourth and final episode in our special Advent podcast series. So welcome, Dom.
Always a pleasure to be with you both.
This has been a great series, and I'm looking forward to this last episode. Dom, you described the differences between Matthew's nativity story and Luke's nativity story, but you promised us that today we'd focus on how the two gospels are alike. Like, what do they share, and what might they agree about? But David, I think you had a question to start us off.
Yeah, I'd like to hear, Dom, you address this whole idea. You know, a lot of people, if you start talking parable, the first thing they want to say is, so wait a minute, you're saying these are just stories, they're not really true? How would you respond?
I would have to admit that if somebody put the question like that, I know the case is probably gone already, because they've said just a story.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let me back up a little bit. When Jesus wanted to say something about the kingdom of God, that is how God wants the world to be run, as distinct, say, from how the kingdom of Rome, Jesus told parables. A parable is a fiction. It's a made-up story. A parable, however, is a story that could happen. It's not like a fable with talking animals, let's say. A parable could happen, but it's never told for that. So the classic example, of course, as you well know, is the Good Samaritan. Jesus made up that story. I do not think, if I want to put it negatively, there was ever a person in the ditch. There was a Samaritan that stopped, that he had a donkey, put a man on the donkey, took him to an inn, paid two denarii. I don't think a single part of that is historically true. In other words, if you were there with a camera, you'd have caught it. And having said that, I have said something which is profoundly silly and totally irrelevant. Of course it's a parable. And that's why at the end of it, Luke could say, I think I mentioned this one in the other one talks, go and do likewise. And he certainly didn't mean go out, become a Samaritan, and stay on that road looking for people in the ditch. A parable is a fiction. It's a made-up story. If you don't like it, take it up with Jesus. It wasn't my idea. When Jesus wanted to say something important, he went to parables rather than sermons. The reason he did that, by the way, is because a parable is to get you thinking. It pushes the audience to work. Instead of telling them, here's what you should be doing, and everyone nods their head and goes out and ignores it. Of course, they're called sermons. We all know what happens. We nod our head, leave, and forget. Jesus tells them a story. So at the end of the Good Samaritan, let's hope, people go off saying, I don't know, would a Samaritan really do that? You know, they're not nice people, but we just saw one doing something that's nice. Well, maybe they're not all bad people. How do we know they're bad people? Have we seen them all? Well, we were told they're bad people. They make you think. And in fact, I think at the end of a parable of Jesus, and probably interruptions during it, any good audience would keep arguing with him, argue back. If he didn't, and they just filed past him after the end and said, lovely parable this morning, Rabbi, Jesus failed dismally. If he didn't bug them, annoy them, exasperate them, seduce them, force them into thinking, didn't work. Just didn't work.
So, Dom, these parables were common to the people in the first century, and so it was easy for Jesus to use these parables because it wasn't anything unusual for them. Is that right?
Well, I don't want to say common because it's not clear to me, at least from the examples that we have, that that was the way people did it. Now, if you take, for example, the seven or so stories about Caesar crossing the Rubicon, that was an historical event. It comes to us with parabolic clothing. In other words, Caesar did cross the Rubicon because there's no way to get from, I think it was Ravenna to Rimini or wherever it was, unless he flew or came by sea, except crossing this river. He never even bothers mentioning it, by the way. But when we tell that story and somebody says, a haggard woman appeared on the other side and said, do not cross, or a glorious woman said, come pass, you know, we're parabolizing the historical. Mm-hmm. We're taking an historical event, and if we think he shouldn't have done it, we tell the story as if he shouldn't have done it. And if we think he did and should have done it, we do the opposite. We do that all the time. We parabolize events. Sometimes they're called misinformation and fake news, by the way, but that's a separate issue. Now, but when Jesus tells a parable, I don't think he took an incident that happened and sort of dramatized it or changed it. Or let's say he knew a story, a Samaritan passed by and didn't do anything. I think what is unusual is that it seems, at least as we get the story in the gospel, it almost seems like his dominant mode of teaching is parable. That he doesn't give what you get in John's gospel, long sermons. So it would surprise me very much if then those who were closest to Jesus, when they tried to teach, didn't pick up this bad habit of using fiction. And I would simply say to people who want something else, please take it up with God. It was not my idea. I think Luke knew exactly what Luke was doing when he was writing those first two chapters. I don't think for a second he thought he was writing history, because he was writing backwards, as it were, after having written his gospel, and Matthew, having written his gospel, knew exactly what he wanted to say. And that's why the stories are so completely different. Of course they're different, because the gospels are basically different ways of, I might say, parabolizing. So if we don't like it, it's too bad, because we're not doing it. We can, of course, say everything is historical, everything is accurate. These are four people saying exactly what happened. But the consensus of scholarship is that Matthew and Luke copy from Mark and change Mark extensively. Now, we would call that plagiarism, to put it bluntly. If I did to a writing today what Matthew and Luke did to Mark, I would be in court for plagiarism. In the ancient world, it was apparently acceptable to do that because they did it. And if we don't like it, it's just too bad, because unfortunately we can't make things. I know it's a kind of a cottage industry at the moment, making things be something else. It's possible, for example, at the moment to say that counting is cheating. It's possible at the moment to say that losing is winning, that lying is witnessing. I know we're used to all of that at the moment, and we've got too used to it. But basically, things should be called by their proper name. If I'm reading history, for example, when Jesus was crucified by Pilate, that, as far as I am concerned, is history. It happened. Now, if you try to interpret that and say what it means, Romans will say one thing, Christians will say something else. They'll interpret it differently, of course. That's perfectly valid, different interpretations. But you're not allowed, for example, to say Jesus wasn't really crucified. He just had, you know, a bad day in Jerusalem and left. You're not allowed to say that. And you're not allowed to say he was lynched or stoned. You can certainly, and are called to, interpret it. You can decide it's a good day for the Romans. But that's interpretation of the fact. Now, in a parable, you're not interpreting a fact. You're creating a fiction to challenge people's vision of life. That's the purpose of a parable, to provoke you to participation, to make you respond.
A little clarification, Dom, just for our listening audience. So Mark is believed to have been written first, and we're talking about Matthew and Luke. How many years, you were mentioning something about they took Matthew's material and wrote it quite differently. How many years between when Mark was written and when Matthew and Luke were written?
All right, let me once again emphasize that no amount of disagreement on those years and calculating the years, which is the cottage industry in scholarship, changes the fact that there is a massive consensus of scholars. And for me, a massive consensus of scholars is called a miracle. So I treat it with great respect, but it doesn't happen a lot. It really doesn't.
Okay.
That Mark is the first of the four written, and that Matthew and Luke use him as their sort of their major source. And that therefore, if you read comparatively, as I mentioned before, across from one to the other in parallel columns, you can see, for example, how Matthew and Luke change Mark, and then you can ask yourself the question, at least a cumulative question, why do I think Matthew changed him this way? Why do I think Matthew omitted that? Matthew expanded that? And why the same for Luke? That's simply called gospel scholarship. It's what I've spent my life doing. And the reason that I have some idea, somebody says, well, how do you know what Matthew intended? Well, because I can read what he's doing time after time after time, and I can begin to see. Let me give you an example. Mark says Jesus was what we could translate as a carpenter. Matthew and Luke read that. Mark says Jesus was a carpenter. Let me go with that translation when we know. Matthew doesn't like that. That makes Jesus sound a bit like a day laborer, which is what it really means. So Matthew changes to say his father was a carpenter. And then Luke looks at it and says, nah, I don't like that either. I think I just leave it out. That tends to be the way that Matthew handles something and Luke handles something in Mark they don't like. Matthew will change it. Luke will omit it. So after I've read them over and over again, I'm talking about decades of scholarship, you begin to see, all right, there is no way I can say that Matthew, Mark, and Luke are simply witnesses in the court of law doing their level best to explain exactly what happened, granted some forgetfulness and all the rest of it. It just doesn't work. And I can't deny that unless I'm going to turn the good news into fake good news. Which is possible, by the way. That's also a cottage industry. I have to accept the two disciplines I mentioned to you before, what I call historical matrix, trying to understand what these first century people meant, and then authorial intention. What are they up to? Once I'm finished with that, then I can say, here's what I think they tried to communicate. And then, of course, I have to make the second and the more important decision that we all have to make. If these are claims upon our own life, not just for the first century, but for all centuries, do we think they're still valid? Or it's not right to read a story that's making claims upon your way of life as if it was just, you know, a yarn. It's not just a yarn. It's a yarn that says, this is how you should live. Okay, I'm quite capable of reading it and say it's wrong. But I shouldn't say, well, it's not saying this is how I should live. So if I'm dealing respectfully with any writer, I have to try and understand what claims is this writer making. And the writer can make those claims with a parable or a metaphor or a fiction. What are we reading fiction for, apart from to pass the time? When we get into a story, we say, does it change us? So basically, it's a parable, and I never use the term like myth because that often means a lie. And I'm quite certain that these people knew what they were doing, because I can watch Matthew change Mark. And I could say to him, "Were Matthew here? Matthew, how dare you change what Jesus said in Mark?" And Matthew would probably say, "But I'm writing for a different audience. I have to adapt what Jesus said in the 30s or the 70s to what I need now in the 80s or the 90s. Matthew would probably say in Aramaic, don't you get it? That's what a gospel is. It's good news for the time, good news for now. Anyway, that's, as I said, parables are here whether we like it or not.
Yes, yes. Okay. So they were. So
let me go from that, because okay. That's a good segue into, let's take, for example, the story of the virginal conception. We sometimes say the virginal birth. That's not correct. But Matthew and Luke both take it for granted, as far as I can see, that Jesus is born by a virginal conception. Now, let me for a moment not say, well, I don't think after the Enlightenment that ever happens. And by the way, I would agree with that. I don't think any human being has ever been born of any God and a human mother. I can stop like that. And that's a little bit absurd for an adult. It's a little, you know, puerile or even adolescent negativity. It's like being thrilled when you're 4 years of age to know that Santa doesn't exist. Yeah, but that doesn't explain where the gifts come from and why the gifts come from. So the question then becomes for me, in the first century, what did it mean for people to make a claim that Jesus was born virginally? Did everyone in the first century, like you and I might do it today, say, oh, come on, we don't believe that? So to answer that question, I have to go back before the Enlightenment to try and understand the first century. And what I find out in the first century is that they were quite at home with miracles. That the Romans loved miracles, for Romans, by the way. And the Jews loved miracles for Jews. Now, the Romans didn't believe in Jewish miracles, and the Jews didn't believe in Roman miracles. But everyone believed in their own miracles. And along come the Christians, and lo and behold, don't believe in Jewish miracles or Roman miracles, but they're quite good at Christian miracles. Okay, so we're in a world of miracles. Now, the only response in a world of miracles is not that couldn't happen. You can't say that because you know what happens in your tradition. You have to say, well, you might say, well, that couldn't happen to that guy or that person or that time. You could say that. But the more open question is, okay, fine. So what? Big deal. We live in a world of miracles. So you got one more. Why should I care? Now, that is an honest pre-Enlightenment, first century question. And let me say, Paul would be perfectly happy to hear that. So let me exemplify it. In the first century world, I'm talking about the culture across the whole first century world. If you were talking about somebody, male or female, though fortunately they were mostly male, who had lived an extraordinary life. Now here's what we're starting with. This person has done something of extraordinary value for the human race. It could be, for example, like Asclepius, who has invented healing. Wow, that's a huge gift for the human race. We give the person a Nobel Prize or something. And the person has thereby revealed some of the power of God. The gods want us to be healed. So we will call this person divine. Now, we know this person is human, but it's a divine human being. Now, that's not our language. And for the moment, I don't care whether it's our language or not. It's their language. And courtesy tells me I should shut up and listen for a moment. Okay. In the first century, anyone who has done, a human being, who has done something of extraordinary value for the human race, or at least our local part of it, we will consider divine. And when they die, we will send them up among the gods, or up to God, if it's like Moses or something like that. And furthermore, we're not going to say they were simply conceived because Mr. and Mrs. Alexander had a little bit too much wine one night and conceived Alexander. That's a little bit tame. And we're going to say that a god, and we'd certainly say like Mars or Zeus, came down and conceived with this human mother, a divine child. Now, of course, the child will do extraordinary, because that's the job description. So let me take an example, getting a little bit local. Augustus Caesar, according to the tradition, was born when the god Apollo, now it's interesting, not the god Mars, the god of war, it's not Zeus, it's Apollo, the god of prophecy, the god of order, the archer god of accuracy. Augustus's mother, Atzia, went to the temple of Apollo, fell asleep during the service, and was impregnated that night by Apollo in the guise of a snake. I leave the snake to your Freudian imagination for the moment. But of course, Alexander had also been conceived by Zeus in the form of a snake. So that's the story. Caesar Augustus, looking backwards, that was not the story around, I've forgotten when he was born, I think it was about 63 BCE or something. That wasn't the story that Atzia told the morning after she found out she was conceived. That arrived, I think it was from Egypt actually, long after he was Caesar Augustus, famous, had brought peace to the Roman world, had pacified the whole empire, everything was going great, and we have to explain how could such an extraordinary person be conceived and we come up with. Now notice, it's not a virginal conception. It is a conception by a human mother and a divine father. Now, leave aside the Roman tradition, and that's absolutely good Greco-Roman tradition. And I suppose if Jesus had been a Roman hero, we'd probably have that story about him. Let me shift over to the Jewish tradition. How did they handle somebody of supreme importance? Somebody who was not probably a powerful general, but a very holy person. They were not born of their God and a human mother. They were born of aged and hereto infertile parents. Now, by the way, that's a really good one, because that is clinically checkable. If you wanted to, you can't check the Roman story, but you could say, were they really 80 years old?
Oh, yeah.
When they remember the story of Abraham and Sarah, when Sarah is told by God that she's going to conceive, she laughs and says, from him?
Yes.
From him?
You talking about this guy?
Because they're aged and infertile. So when you look at both those stories, now I'm a first century writer, and I'm looking at both those stories, and I want to say, our Jesus was far more extraordinary than anyone in the Roman tradition or anyone else in his own Jewish tradition. Now, that's a huge claim, okay, but I'm making it. How do I describe his conception? I'm not going to have any form of intercourse at all, not divine intercourse by God and not aged intercourse from infertile parents. I'm going to have a virginal conception. God will simply say, let it be. It'll be like creation. Let it be. Now, an aside, a footnote. In none of those Roman conceptions does a god ever ask permission. They're all divine rapes. But at least in the human story of Mary, Mary has to say, be it done. Mary has to say yes. But still, what you have is you've imagined a virginal conception, which, from your point of view, is more transcendentally miraculous than anything in the Roman tradition, anything in the Jewish tradition. It's a virginal conception. Now, that's the claim that's been made. Put it in discussable terms. our Jesus is more important to the world, that's what you're talking about, than anyone in the whole Roman tradition, including especially Caesar Augustus, by the way, a little pointed, or anyone in the Jewish tradition either. You're making a transcendental claim. Now, when I come to discuss that, if I wanted to discuss it, I would never ask, do I think there was a virginal conception? Because my answer is no. And having said that, I've only begun the discussion, because the discussion then is, do you think and do you accept, which is the question to Christians that makes you a Christian, that Jesus is of transcendental value to the entire world? Your answer could be no. I think Jesus was just a nice guy who, you know, told little stories and patted little babies. Okay, but then I'm saying the claim they're making is wrong. If I accept the claim, of course, that makes me a Christian. And I'm supposed to start figuring out how you live according to your acceptance of Jesus as the norm for life in the world. So a metaphor or a parable makes a claim on you. You are perfectly free to say, no way. You're not perfectly free to say it doesn't make a claim. Let me use a very kind of a silly one. Just let me get away with this. If you said today that somebody is a chicken, in our culture, that's kind of an insult. It's a metaphor, of course. Person isn't a chicken. So-and-so is a chicken. That's a metaphor. It's an insult. If I were to say so-and-so is an eagle, that's a compliment in our culture, but it's also a metaphor. Now, if you and I got into an argument about somebody being a chicken or an eagle, we're not talking feathers.
Of course.
We're talking about prowess, value, something like that. So when we hear these, if we dismiss them, let me give you an example. Years and years ago, oh, they put me on the front cover of the Chicago Tribune Sunday magazine. And I talked about all of this, more or less, and the editor of it in there, who was interested, actually, in being a kid, a little adolescent iconoclast, you know, I'm going to say, get over it, came up with a long list of things that didn't happen. He went through Luke 1 and 2, Matthew 1 and 2, and listed all the things that didn't happen, which would be a silly, profoundly silly, as me going through the Good Samaritan and saying, this didn't happen, this didn't happen, this didn't happen, this didn't happen. At the end of it, you want to say, grow up, will you? Grow up, get a life. That's not the way you read a 2,000-year-old story. It's not the way you read any story, by the way. But anything that's been around for 2,000 years, before you dismiss it, be careful. Be very careful that you know why you're dismissing it and if it's worthy of dismissal. So anyway, that's what virginal conception is about. That's the claim that's been made. And that's why, for example, you won't find it anywhere in Paul. Paul doesn't think it. It's not something he wants to say. You won't find it in Mark. You won't find it in John, probably. It's part of something in one tradition, one way of saying how important Jesus is. John agrees, by the way, John's gospel, that Jesus is important. But, of course, he makes him say much more different things, like before Abraham was, I was. So you're making the same claim in different ways. Does that make any sense to you at all?
Oh, definitely.
Let me put one footnote when I think. You know, very often when I say that, people say, so it's all just a metaphor. And I want to say, please, metaphors are the building blocks of reality when they're lived. For example, in the 30s, in the 1930s, not the first century 30s, in the 1930s, the New Deal was a metaphor for a way of seeing it and a way of living it. So was the Third Reich, both about the same things around 1933-34. Now, both of them were lived out. One was horror, and the other was much better. At least I think it was. So we create reality by the metaphors we make and decide to live them out. Of course, if they don't bother living them out, then they're just dead metaphors. But that's a metaphor. So anyone who says just a metaphor doesn't understand reality. We make a metaphor. If we decide to live it, it comes out one way. I don't think I should have to say this in 2020 after 4 years of living a certain metaphor. And you find out when you live a metaphor whether it works or not. The Third Reich worked for 12 years. I do think the New Deal worked a little longer. But they're both metaphors. So is democracy. So is tyranny. So is oligarchy. So is monarchy. They're metaphors that we try to live out and see if they work. And, of course, they have to change because metaphors change whether we like it or not. So anyone who says it's just a metaphor, I know I've lost it. I can't really explain to that person. It's almost like somebody saying, well, it's just reality.
So, Dom, can we now move to the promise of telling us what Matthew and Luke find agreement on?
Yes, that's the first thing I've just said, of course, is that's one thing they agree. We've already seen one major thing they agree upon. That is to understand that the rule of God and the rule of Rome, which is actually simply the normalcy of civilization, are on a collision course. That's the rock bottom basic that they both agree on. And when they go, for example, to the second agreement, which I've just mentioned, the virginal conception of Jesus, that is simply a way of expressing that Jesus, as I said, is more important to the world than anything Rome especially can produce because that's the story of Caesar Augustus. Now, let me look at a second one. Both of them agree, Luke and Matthew's overture agree, that Jesus was born in Bethlehem, right? We saw that before, that Matthew took it for granted they were living there and only went to Nazareth after returning from Egypt. And we saw, of course, that Luke gets Jesus from Galilee to Bethlehem for the census. But anyway, why did they choose Bethlehem? Why Bethlehem? Wouldn't it be much more important to be born in Jerusalem, the capital city? Wouldn't that mean how important he was? The answer, of course, everyone knew. Bethlehem was where David was born. And David was the once and future king. To say born in Bethlehem would be like us saying that a president, for example, let's say some president believed he was born in a log cabin. We would know that born in a log cabin is an allusion to Lincoln. And if we said some president thinks he was born in a log cabin, or let's say she was born in a log cabin, then that would mean they think they're like Lincoln. So born in Bethlehem means new David, not new Moses like Matthew has, but new David. What does that mean now? Again, you notice we keep having to ask, what does that mean? What does that mean? In the first century, if somebody said Jesus was the new David, what did it mean? Well, what we do is if we go back to the first century, Romans had arrived, as I said, with Pompey around 60 BCE, about 60 years before the time of Jesus, Pompey arrived in the Middle East and in Jerusalem and desecrated the temple by going into it. Around that same time, the Psalms of Solomon were written, probably by Pharisees, possibly, and in there they announced the coming of the Messiah, the awaited one, the one who would liberate the homeland. And they said the Messiah will liberate us by the word of his mouth. By the word of his mouth. Now, wait a minute. That doesn't quite sound like a military strategy. Is it really going to work for the Messiah to say, Romans, go home? So I think if you went around the first century and took up a poll from ordinary people across the whole Jewish homeland and said, okay, we know that you expect someday that God's going to clean up the mess of the world. Because we know that you have been persecuted by one empire after another. We've read Daniel 7, and we know they keep coming down the Levantine coast or up the Levantine coast, and you get clobbered every time. And now you have the Romans. And we know your ancient hope that God is going to give eventually, you mentioned it the other day, a world of peace and distributive justice, a world where everyone can beat their swords into pruny hooks and their spears into weapons of agriculture, not weapons of war, where we won't have weapons of war made of iron, but weapons of agriculture made of iron. And everyone could have their own possessions, and no one will make them afraid. Now, you got the Romans. How is God going to do it? They would have said, well, and you, David. David freed us from the Philistines of old, that David will come again, like Arthur in the Arthurian legend. It'll be a new David, and he'll free us from the Romans. And then comes the huge question, the daunting question, the supreme question. Will he liberate you from the Romans by violence or nonviolence? And I want to insist at this point, I'm not asking a modern question. I'm not saying at all, I'm projecting back into the first century any ideas we may have learned from the 19th or the 20th century about nonviolent resistance. And I'm not talking about pacifism, by the way, I'm talking about nonviolent resistance. Because if I can leave Jesus aside for a moment, in 4 BCE, by the time Jesus was born, there was a huge violent rebellion by the Jews against the Romans, the time of the death of Herod the Great. And it was put down viciously by the Roman legions from Syria, who crucified 2,000 people in Jerusalem. In the year 66, 70 years later, again an armed revolt, which ended up with the legions again coming from Alexandria and Antioch, decimating the country, ruining Jerusalem, burning the temple to the ground, slaughtering 500 a day were crucified outside Jerusalem till they ran out of trees. Now, in between those two violent revolts, the 70 years, there are in Josephus countless numbers of organized, large-scale, nonviolent resistance. Jews were experimenting with nonviolent resistance in the years between those two terrible revolts. It's against that background that I see the nonviolence of Jesus. Nonviolent resistance was an option in the air, and so was violent resistance, of course, all during the life of Jesus. So he didn't invent it. It was there as an option. But he united it to the kingdom of God.
Saddam, people in the first century or during this period of time were being very oppressed, and their life was challenging and very difficult. Is it safe to say that because of the conditions that people were living in and because of the domination of Rome and because of the violence, that Matthew and Luke were looking for something that would encourage people to have hope, or that there was going to be something else, a change in the world, so that, and we've talked about peace would happen. Is that at all part of this?
It is, but I want you to understand very clearly that Rome had established the Pax Romana. It's not as if there is a, how would I put it, a war going on. Rome is Romanizing, and Romanizing is commercializing. And commercializing is unifying the whole thing for the good of Rome, of course. So, for example, when Antipas commercializes the lake, It's bad news for the ordinary fishermen, but of course it's good news for the aristocracy. They can now take the fish dried, salted, all the way to the Tyre and send it into the international global market of the Mediterranean. So I don't want us to think as if the Romans were walking around Palestine beating off the peasants. They weren't. That's not how an economic globalization takes over. For some people, it was good news. For some, it was probably very good news if you could control the fishing. So Rome is organizing the Jewish homeland for the good of Rome and its aristocracy. Was it good for the ordinary peasants? No. It was peaceful, if you want to put it that way. But it was the peace of an economic tyranny, to put it that way. That's the best way to put it. So you have to understand, for example, that Jesus started in Galilee, and what he was opposing was the commercialization of the lake under Antipas, who moved his capital from inland Sepphoris to a new capital on the lake shore. And he didn't do that for the breeze. He did that for the fish. So if you were a small peasant who was used to getting some protein supplement from fish, you probably couldn't do it under Antipas' control of the lake. So Jesus and John the Baptist, by the way, start off as nonviolent resistance to Antipas. That's why John ends up executed, John the Baptist executed by Antipas, as Jesus would by Pilate. So there, what you're dealing with sort of is an economic oppression that's good for some people, of course. Good for the haves, and when Jesus makes his famous statement that the haves get more and the have-nots get less, which sounds like, you know, almost like impossible. If you have nothing, how can you get less?
Exactly.
I think most of the peasants around Galilee would have nodded their head and said, yeah, I used to have a family farm. It wasn't much, God knows, I was poor. But now I've lost the farm to a commercial operation, and I'm scrounging for work in the streets of Tiberias. So, yeah, the haves get more, and the have-nots get less.
Well, and that sounds a lot like what's going on in present day.
Well, you have to watch in any globalization who gets it and who doesn't. It's not news. It really is not news. And it's not ever fair in the globalization simply to count the billionaires. There were people in the Roman world, of course, getting much richer than if they were having a war with the Parthians or if the Celts were invading, you know, from the north or anything else. Of course, the Pax Romana was a pax. So you have to understand that the very idea of a Jesus or a John the Baptist or a Paul saying this is not the will of God must have seemed to most people in the first century, the haves, the ones who are writing the stories, absurd. Of course it's the will of God, because first of all, Caesar is divine. And how could it not be the will of God if we have peace across the Roman Empire and business is booming? And John or Jesus would say, ask not for whom the boom booms, it may not boom for thee. You know? So that's the basic question they're asking all the time. And when Jesus then in Jerusalem speaks up for distributive justice to Pilate, Pilate would have said, but we're in charge of distributive justice. We're in charge of distribution.
So, Dom, we could do this for several more hours and I wouldn't get tired, I know. What would you want to do now to summarize all of these observations?
Well, I'm going to say two things. One thing, we could turn around and focus immediately on the transition that's going on in this country at the moment, which is very similar to the transition going on in the first century.
Yes.
But as I'm talking to you, I'm talking from home, and I'm looking out at a grove of live oaks. And they're very beautiful. They have branches actually that go in one single oak all the way across the whole side of the house. They're all beautiful, but when hurricanes come through, it's not the branches that count, it's the roots.
Mm-hmm.
What brings the branches down if the roots don't hold? So I don't know if again and again we take on this empire, that empire, and we've been at it now for 2,000 years. I think we have to revitalize the roots as well as look at the branches.
Mm-hmm. I love that.
Yeah.
I'd like us to go back and really not take out Luke 1 and 2, Matthew 1 and 2, like we do the Christmas ornaments. Take them out nicely, you know, treat them with great respect. Take them out of the attic or the basement or wherever they are. Set them up, admire them for a week or 2 weeks. Then fold them up carefully and put them back again to next year and do the same thing over and over and over
right.
again while nothing changes outside.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So two things. Empower yourself from those roots, and then you'll know how to handle the branches, what should get cut off and what should be nurtured and what could be expanded.
Yes. I like it.
I think, to be honest with you, Matthew and Luke would not get on at all. And if I threw Paul into the mix, he'd be on the side of Matthew. I'm a little bit scared about how Romanized Luke is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I can see all the things that I've said. But every Roman official, that runs into Paul, or in fact Pilate with Jesus, declares them innocent.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a little bit afraid that Matthew sees what never happened. A Jewish Christianity, if I can use that terminology.
Yes.
And Luke kind of sees a Roman Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
And granted those two options, I find myself more on the side of Jewish Christianity, which never happened. I know that. It only happened for a short time when you had Messianic Judaism for a while. And the reason I say that is because the Jewish people had been working with empires for 500 years. They had no delusions about them. I think Christianity and Luke has some delusions about the Roman Empire.
Yes.
That maybe it can be easily Christianized. And I think, if I could imagine, and I'll close with this, a Jewish rabbi and a Roman bishop walking along, say, the Golden Horn in Constantinople in the 400s, and the Roman Christian bishop saying, "We are now the religion of the Roman Empire," saying kind of proudly. And I think the Jewish rabbi would say, "Yes, I know, but if you are the religion of the Roman Empire, that's like the army of the Roman Empire, the navy, that means they own you."
Yes.
And the bishop would say, "Oh, no, we've converted them." And I think the Jewish rabbi would have been wise enough to say, "We will see then who has converted whom."
Yes.
And with that, Don, this has just been thoroughly enjoyable. And now I have two Christmas stories to enjoy. And some days I might be in the mood for Matthew's story, and some days I might be in the mood for Luke's story. Thank you so much, Don. These four episodes have just been so enjoyable, and it's just been a pleasure. And I thank you so much for spending this time.
And a pleasure for me too, Deborah and David.
Thank you for listening, and please remember, if you're interested in reading Dr. Crossan and Marcus's book, The First Christmas, it can be purchased at most bookstores, and you can always go online to Amazon. It would make a terrific Christmas gift. This has been a production of the D.L. Deitch Jr. Foundation, producers of Faith and Reason seminars and educational programming. Additional funding is provided by the Wendland Cook Foundation. For home study materials, please remember to visit our website, www.faithandreason.org.